from 2007 to 2009 with Nikki. And I currently work at the Wagner School, which is NYU's School of Public Policy, Nonprofit Management. And I'm an academic advisor there. And I also did the higher ed program at NYU, and I took all my electives in international ed. So.
You worked at OASS, where I work right now.
No way. Yeah. Oh, okay, we're going to talk later. Okay. So, and I worked at the Office for International Students and Scholars and also at the Study Abroad Office.
My name is Shannon Spisak. I was a JET for 2 years in Kawasaki City, which is a pretty urban area for JET. And I worked when I came to New York at Barnard College at Columbia University. But I think right now I'm the only one on the panel who's not currently at an actual university. I work now at the Institute of International Education, which is kind of, feels like kind of a blend between higher education and the UN sort of work. And I can talk a little more about that later. But I manage scholarship programs, essentially, which has a, sort of a component of admissions to it in addition to support, financial support, grants, and just program cycles in general.
I'm Clara Solomon. I was in Sapporo Prefecture from the UN to 01, and I was a CIR, which doesn't, well, maybe makes a little bit of a difference, but probably not that much. And now I am at NYU Law, where I'm the Director of Company and Career Development, and mostly I work with our 300-plus foreign.
Hi everyone, my name is Jillian Rodriguez. I am not a JET alumnus. I have a friend of Kat, that's why I'm here. My career in higher education, I've only ever worked in higher education, through one corporate world, has been in three areas. I was in fundraising for 6 years, at my alma mater, Hofstra University on Long Island, and then the Law School of Columbia and the Business School, and then UT Student Affairs. I was there for 5 years, Director of Student Life at the Business School of Columbia, and I recently moved in August to work at a research center with one of our faculty members, the Program for Financial Studies. So.
Who wants financial
work? I'm Katrina. I'm Katrina Barnes, otherwise known as Kat to many. I was a JET from Intiba Ken. 2001 to 2002, and as you can see in my bio, I kind of ended up staying in Japan for another year because I did journalism as an undergrad degree, and so I worked at Toyota in corporate communications for about a year and a half after that. Came back, didn't know what I wanted to do, ended up in higher ed, and where I've been for the last 7 years. I work at the Chazen Institute at Columbia Business School, and we're one of the research centers, and I work on our study tour programs where the business students learn about culture in different countries. So my students are in their 20s and 30s. But being the kids, and they go over and on short study abroad programs, and also since Asia is, you know, Japan and China, same country, I ended up with on all the Chinese initiatives that we're doing at the school as well. So I run a speaker series, I do deal with visiting scholars based in China, I work with our faculty members on doing new stuff in China, and since our director is Chinese, we do a lot on China.
Thank you. So how this is going to work is basically I prepare some questions, and you know, any of you can answer, or all of you can answer it. The chat is going to be pretty exciting. Also, if you have any questions, you know, feel free to ask them anytime. So I'm, you know, the first question is, how did you guys get into this field?
We'll work our way out. When I first came home from JET, I was CIR, so I thought, I want to do something that, like, I'm going to speak Japanese, I'm going to be an interpreter, or whatever. And I worked at JETRA, which is, like, the New York office of the Japanese Ministry of Finance. Quickly learned that I hated finance. And also, being a researcher, a financial researcher, I wasn't talking to anybody all day. I had, like, a Bloomberg terminal and a Wall Street Journal, and that was basically my job, and it was really miserable. Except for lunch where I got to talk to my Japanese friends. So I actually, this is not the first ever panel for Jitani on higher ed, because there was one in 2002 that inspired me to go into higher education. we didn't used to do that big career forum. We used to do these kind of smaller things. And I went to that, and there was someone there who worked in international student services, like doing the F-1 visa processing. And I was like, oh, that sounds kind of cool. And I talked to her. And she encouraged me to talk to more people, and that kind of gave me the push to to leave Jethro and go to NYU. And I started out as an admin assistant in my office, and now I'm director, so there's definitely promotional opportunities in this field as well.
I'll go next. I fell into higher education. When I graduated, I thought I wanted to be a kindergarten teacher. And I thought I took enough loans out for undergrad that I was going to go for free. So I was going to get a job on campus. And again, I said I graduated from Hofstra on Long Island in 2000. So there were two admin jobs open, and one was in development. I didn't even know what development was. I'm like, what are they developing? And I was fortunate enough to interview and get that first job out of college. And I really enjoyed being on campus. If any of you are familiar with Hofstra, we're a National Arboretum, so it was a really beautiful place to be. And after about almost 2 years, I decided I needed to move back to the city. My boyfriend at the time was from New York, and he was in advertising. He was commuting a lot. He was working late hours. So I got a job at the law school, and I remember people saying, you want to work at Columbia, you have to know somebody. And I thought, no, you don't. You just have to be a hard worker and have some experience and be persistent. So I went to the law school. I was there for 11 months, and then I left to go to the business school, and I felt terrible, but my boss really pushed me forward when I started the law school as support staff, which was a union position. And there really was not much growth in that office, and I had other colleagues telling me, stop working so hard, you're making us look bad, and I thought, this is not good. So a wonderful officer opportunity opened up at the business school in fundraising, and I took that. And then I just kind of really wanted to work with students. I was in contact with students through a couple of programs that I ran, and being on campus seemed like the right place to be. I should say that the fundraising office for Columbia Business School is located on 60th Street. So I was not on campus. That whole wanting to be on campus, I wasn't on campus. And that was part of the reason why I moved to student affairs.
Okay, I'll go. So when I came back from JET, I didn't really know where I wanted to go or what skills I had. And higher ed wasn't the first place that I landed. I ended up doing a couple of years at a small company that was a Japanese subsidiary of an import-export company. They had a very small office here in New York, and I got my job through one of the recruiters that attend often our career forum. Like Clara, I also had met with others who were in sort of the international industry during that time to figure out what my next step was, because I knew I didn't really want to stay there. When I started learning more about the types of positions that were available, I also started realizing that a lot of them were looking for master's degrees, which I didn't have. So part of the decision also, like Jillian, was how can I work somewhere and also get my degree? So let's look at, you know, what positions are available at universities. So I ended up transitioning into, well, first I thought I was going to work at the UN, actually. And I had talked to a couple of JET alums, and one of them worked at the UN, and I was like, oh, that sounds so, you know, exciting and interesting, and who doesn't want to work at the UN? So I started my job at Barnard College and had to wait a while for the tuition reimbursement to kick in, which was a little bit shocking. I was like, I want to get started right away, but I had to wait for a little while. And I looked at the programs. I was excited that TC actually had an international education program and also one with a focus in peace education, because my mentor at the time had said, if you want to work at the UN, they're really looking for a peace education specialty. And I was like, oh, well, first of all, I didn't even know what peace education was. But secondly, I was very excited that TC had it. So I was like, great, I can figure out what this is and, you know, get some degree along the way. So as I went through that process, I was a part-time student. It took me a while to go through. And the classes that I had that kind of revolved around working at the UN and talking with people, guest speakers that had come from the UN, I started to realize maybe this isn't exactly the type of culture that I'm looking for. So what else is out there that's kind of sort of like that, but maybe a little bit more like working at a university? Because I had started to really enjoy being on campus and just kind of the energy that you're surrounded by, you know, students who are, you know, going to school and kind of feeling motivated and, you know, the whole world ahead of them. I thought this is kind of a fun place to work. So I was kind of looking for something that was sort of a blend of that. And I ended up at IIE basically because there was another JET who worked there. And I wasn't totally sold on the organization initially, because it is very administrative, and when I talked to her about it, you know, it's kind of like, well, you're really a service provider, you're kind of a middleman, you work sometimes at universities, you work with students, you work with government organizations or corporate foundations, but you're kind of in the middle of all of it. But the more I got to learn about it, the more I really did sort of see it was kind of like the UN in terms of the programs that they were sponsoring and the types of people that they were working to support, but also like a university in terms of kind of the feeling of working at that organization, and many people also had come from other universities. feel like it was a nice blend. And I guess if I had to answer that question in one word, I would say networking is how I ended up where I was. Mm-hmm. It came through the JET connection.
I'll go next. I, like Jillian and many other people in higher ed, I fell into higher ed. I, as I said before, I had a journalism degree, and when I came back from Japan, I was like, I'm going to be a writer, I'm going to work in advocate. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I started working at a company that a lot of deaf students work at, Trans-Pacific Translation. Did anyone hear about that?
It's like in the building, isn't it?
It was in the building. Thank you for bringing back people. Yeah, I was sorry for a few years. I'm back better now. It's an interesting organization. It's a translation company, and so it's a lot of project management. And I worked there for all 2 months before I decided that this was just not right. They work you kind of like, I kind of say it's kind of slave labor. They keep you there a lot of hours and don't pay you very much, and they work you really, really hard. It was difficult for me because I've never quit a job and then not had a job waiting. So I quit the job because I was really an unhappy person, and those who know me know I'm generally very bright and bubbly. So I quit the job, and then things worked out. Maybe a week or two later that month, I saw a posting on the JET announcements for a job at Columbia. Because my boss is a JET alum. He has family, so he doesn't usually come to these things. But so he had posted up there. So I had never looked in higher ed. I never thought about higher education. I just kind of was like, I work for a business magazine, and this is an international office, and I like to travel, so why not? So I'm in a weird kind of niche at the business school in that it is a center. I work with a lot of students, but I'm not in Office of Student Affairs or any of those kind of offices. But through my work, I do work with the Career Services Office and Jillian's office and a lot of other places. So that's kind of how I ended up there. And I was amazed that at 5 o'clock they were like, you should leave now. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? I mean, the last job was like 10 o'clock, and they're like, you really should do some more work. but I also started in the summer, which in anybody who works in academia knows the summer is nice and quiet. My office does work very hard, and we are workaholics in my office, and now we definitely never leave at 5 o'clock, but that's just because we keep expanding, and there were travel opportunities, so I kept staying for 7 years.
Okay, so I actually took a very direct route into higher ed, because I knew I wanted to do it when I was in college. So my senior year, I kind of did informational interviews with the deans and administrators at my school, and I asked them how to get into higher ed, and they said to go to grad school. So I applied to JET, and I applied to grad school, and I thought, maybe I'll do JET first, and then go to grad school. Then I got to grad school, and I didn't get into JET. So I went to grad school for higher ed at NYU, and I was a grad assistant at the International Office for International Studies in College. I planned social and cultural events for them. And then I also interned at the Study Abroad office. I worked with the Study Abroad returnees and did programming for them. And we also did recruiting events for Study Abroad. And then when I graduated, I decided I really wanted to do JET before jumping into a career. So I ended up doing JET for 2 years. And then when I got back, I looked for study abroad jobs because that's what I really wanted to do. It's really hard to find a study abroad job because it's very, it's like the most popular job in higher ed, and there's so many people that are qualified for it. So I thought, I have a little experience, I'm going to get it, but there's no opening. So I kind of broadened my search a little bit, and I found this job at Wagner, which was really great because one of my interests in college was public service and public policy, and so that was a good fit. And also, they know that I'm interested in international, working with international students with study abroad, so they let that be part of my job, even though it's not in my job description. So, yeah.
Well, thank you very much. So the next question I have for you is, what do you like about your job, and what do you think are the challenges? So anyone
else? I could start on this one. I, as I said, I've been there for 7 years, so it's been a while. But I love the fact that I'm constantly learning. Being in a university environment means I can go to lectures when I'm not too slumped. And I get new group of students every year, so even though sometimes I have a tendency to get a little bitter because it's the same crop of people coming through, and they say, let's do it this way. I'm like, yeah, you're not the first to say that. So that's one of the challenges, is that you have to keep saying it to people again and again because they have not learned from your mistakes. When you first got there, you're like, oh yeah, we can do it that way, and then you're like, no, this is why we do it our way. But that's actually also a good thing, too, because the students, the business school students I work with are phenomenal. They come with these great backgrounds, and they have wonderful ideas, so I leave them as much flexibility as possible in order to change the programs that I work with. So it's, I mean, the fact that, at least in my position, I get to constantly change what I'm doing. The students every year are, I'm learning new things from the students, I'm learning new things from the program. So one of the things that has been pretty amazing is that I haven't gotten bored of my job earlier. And also, I have a great team environment. My boss is fantastic. There's a lot of educational learning opportunities. I did get my master's, even though that wasn't my plan when I went into it. My master's in public policy. Yay, to like public policy school at FIPA. The unfortunate thing is that a lot of the universities are cutting back, so they're cutting back on tuition benefits, so that's something you should keep in mind if you're looking at jobs. Just ask about that. But it's a great team environment, and the amount of international people I get to work with and business people I get to work with, I adore. So.
Sure. you know, I'm pretty new in my current role, so I'll speak more about the student affairs role. I think, similar to Kat, the being able to work with just really driven, ambitious, and really intelligent students was a wonderful experience. Like Kat mentioned, the fact that they turn over every 2 years is a challenge, so I think I've never worked with an undergrad population. I've only ever worked with graduate students. But that was really one of the challenges, I think, was helping students understand what should be done and how it should be done without telling them what should be done, because at 28 years old they don't want to hear it. So my former boss and I used to always tease that we were, you know, really good at manipulation and using that word in like the best possible sense of the word, which was helping them see why a certain path was the right way to go without actually telling them this is what you have to do because I said so. It does take longer. They'll push back harder. And I think, you know, the students really learn to value the institutional perspective that you bring and to help them realize and get their jobs done a lot quicker. I mean, the one thing that you have to remember with students, they're volunteering. They don't have to do any of this outside of the classroom work. And in our case at our school, you know, we have 400 events per month. There's a lot of active student organizations. So for me, that was one of the greatest challenges, is not having people, you know, do the same mistakes over and over and not waste any of our time. And one of the great things was the fact that they turned over every 2 years. And so, you know, in the past 5 years of working in student affairs, there are something like almost 4,000 students. And, you know, in my role, it was a revolving door in my office. I had a lot of students coming to see me. So when I say 3,500 students, that's, you know, a fair and accurate number. At graduation, I could name almost all of them. And so that was, for me, really rewarding, getting to meet new people and again, the learning. I think it might be different if I worked, let's say, at, like, a school of nursing, where I might not be very interested in the lectures that are going on. But given that my interest is in organizational leadership, organizational change, management, those kinds of things are obviously what our school is about. So I'm fortunate that the environment I'm in, I'm able to learn, and I was able to audit courses as a staff member. And also the tuition benefits that Kat mentioned are really great. And I finished one degree in 2010 in fundraising and nonprofit management, and I'm currently an EDM student at TC and higher in postsecondary education. So. Really taking advantage of those degrees.
That's free money.
Yeah, exactly. It helps supplement your income, right? They don't say a lot.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah.
I think, I mean, I can echo, I work at a professional school, actually, just, I guess we all kind of do, right? Mm-hmm. There's nobody here with undergrad. But one thing about, you know, the law school in particular is that with a couple rare exceptions, including myself, almost everybody who works in administration and in professional schools like ours are what Stephen would call reformed lawyers. So these are people, there's nobody in my office, and I think this is true in a lot of higher ed offices, who are there because they didn't have any other options. They all chose, they gave up much larger salaries than NYU is ever going to be able to offer them to come here. And so all of my colleagues are genuinely happy to be at work every single day, which is, I think, you know, really, really rare. And so, you know, that's really nice. It's, I think across the board, higher ed is generally very relatively flexible. I mean, there are times when I have to be very long hours. There are also times where I can work from home, which means I'm at the playground with my kids for 4 hours and then doing my email at night and, you know, getting, and as long as you're doing a good job and people are trusting you, it tends to be, and I am, I mean, I am a mom. I don't know if I'm the only mom on the field, but it is very family friendly. very family friendly, which is fabulous, and great benefits. Some of the cons, and I don't know if this is unique to NYU, but I have a colleague whose son is applying to colleges right now, and he was looking at all those, like, you know, U.S. News ranking and this and that ranking. The only ranking that he found NYU on was most red tape and bureaucracy, and I think that's true when you work there, too. So, I mean, I don't know, you know, a smaller school might be a different story, but, and I feel the frustration of my students, too, when they come to me and ask me for a question. I'm like, oh, gosh, you actually have to go to office X, Y, and Z to do that, and I wish that I could just do it for them. You know, especially with international students who are like, I have no idea what you're talking about. On the pro to working with international students is that student services does not exist in other countries. And so they're like, I cannot believe that this entire office exists to help me and to, like, review my resume and to answer my questions. Like, this is the most amazing thing ever. And, you know, while some of our American law students might be a little bit entitled, the foreign students do not have any of that, which is a fabulous aspect of working with foreign students. There's a lot more stress, a lot more anxiety, a lot more problems, but a lot more appreciation.
I can say some of that carries over to you in the work that I do, and I'll talk mostly about IIE. At Barnard, I did work more with undergraduate population, but not really in student services. I was in the president's office, so I had sort of limited interaction at the student level. And in terms of my current role, I manage scholarship programs. So, of course, the good news is we're giving people money. We just want to get money. So, you know, that's a benefit, for sure. And generally, you're working with people who are happy to be communicating with you and echoing some of the other comments. Most of the people that work in higher ed, and in my experience, both at Barnard and IIE, want to be there. And yes, you know, they enjoy the environment that they work in. And, you know, they're all kind of motivated by this internal, you know, connection or passion that they have for that type of work. The flip side of that is it does make it sometimes more competitive to find roles and kind of, you know, move up. But in terms of the scholarship programs, I mean, things that I like, and IIE in general, most people probably haven't necessarily heard of IIE, but maybe know the programs that we work on, and especially the Fulbright program. So if you know Fulbright, we're kind of the managing organization for that program. And that model is similar to most of the programs that IIE brings in terms of we have an external funder or sponsor who provides funding for some kind of scholarship or fellowship program. So we work with a range of students in terms of dependent upon what type of program it is, right? So if it's for undergrad students who are applying for a scholarship, we're working with undergrads, and if it's for, you know, Fulbright or postgrad, then we're working with, you know, someone who's in a different age range. So there is a little bit of flexibility in terms of who you work with. One person doesn't necessarily do all of that, however, and IIE is a pretty large organization. We have 6 offices in the U.S. and 13 worldwide. And so some of these programs are basically based out of specific offices, and then even within those offices, especially in New York and D.C., because we're larger, we have multiple divisions within those offices that work with the different types of students and the different types of programs that we offer. So in my division, Fulbright is a very large division of IIE, and I don't work in the Fulbright division. I work mostly with corporate-sponsored programs, foundation-sponsored programs. So one of the benefits for my role also is that because they're smaller types of programs compared to Fulbright, I work with the full program cycle. So I see the very beginning when we're promoting the opportunity to students. We work a little bit in recruiting, depending on the type of program. We process all of the applications, and we manage the or facilitate the selection process. So we're also working with panelists and going through the process of preparing applications for them to be read. And if anyone's sat through, you know, the JET interviews, it's very similar to that process where you're providing applications in advance before scoring them, and then you're coming together and having a discussion about who's receiving these awards. We then get to notify the students, which is also a happy part, except for sometimes when students don't get the awards and then they want, their parents especially want to talk to you about why they didn't receive them. And that's something I think I will say in terms of higher ed as far as challenges are concerned. And maybe this is more at the undergrad level too, because it came up a lot. I don't know.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, dealing with parents. I will say dealing with when people come to me about working in study abroad, that was something also that I was very interested in doing. But I think one of the components that gets overlooked a lot, and sometimes I'm glad that I'm not working in study abroad, is dealing with the U.S. parents who are so concerned about their children being in these international countries, and you having to be on 24/7 to be monitoring them and finding out, you know, you're the middleman from the parent trying to get to the student, and you know that brings on a lot of extra stress and anxiety, and we don't necessarily have that at IIE in terms of the programs that we work on. So that's kind of a benefit. I would also say, this was touched upon kind of jokingly, challenges in international ed are just sort of salary caps. I mean, you're not going to be making, you know, I feel like there's decent salaries there. I wouldn't say, you know, like I feel underpaid, but it's never, you know, an industry where you're going to feel like, yeah, you can live the high life in New York, for example. That's a pretty expensive place to live, so... you know, there's that. And in terms of IIE, because we are sort of a middleman administrative organization, all of our work is based on grant. We're a nonprofit. We're a large nonprofit. So, you know, unlike universities, I mean, whose funding also is sometimes, you know, in flux, our annual cycles really depend on continuing to get funding from sponsors. And so that creates a little bit of challenge in terms of planning, even, you know, how long do you have this program and you're working on it, because your funders can say, oh, you know what, economy's not good this year, I think we're going to back off this program and we may or may not go forward in the future. So there's always kind of that little bit of uncertainty. And knowing that, you know, as much as you want to get a jump start on things and, you know, you're in the cycle and you're starting to learn more about the program, you really can't go forward until you have that green light and you know the funding's in place. So it's a little bit of a balancing act there.
Okay, so I just echo everyone else. The student interaction is great, and also the faculty interaction. Like, I really like being in an intellectual environment, and you get to sit in on talks that happen in your office and things like that. So that's one really good benefit. Also, great coworkers. I've never had a job where, and I love the OSS, but it's a very small office, where you actually get to go and have the hours with your coworkers and have a lot of people that are in your own age. I don't know if you guys have that similar, but I mean, that's really great. Also, I have two terrific bosses, so... it's so nice to have bosses that are really interested in the professional development and are encouraging you to do things. So, like, I know at NYU, there's a number of different professional development opportunities, like, to have different opportunities for you to interact with other people at your office, to go to training sessions or conferences. So that's something I really like. One of the bad things is you have to be the bearer of bad news sometimes. I used to work in student programming, and I was always getting some good news about, you know, like the events they can go to and really fun stuff. And now I have to talk to people about strategies about when they're failing two or three of them. Like, so it's not exactly always the happiest, you know, time when they're talking to me. But yeah, but it's also, you know, I guess you get better at it, you know, for some. But I love crying people, man. And also another con is the money, but there are also like other benefits. I know at NYU the retirement benefits are really good. So if you're looking 40 years in the future, and like health insurance, all that stuff is pretty good care.
Just to add on to one thing that Pam just said, though, in terms of, like, from a manager perspective, and when we were hiring more people in office, we were looking for people who wanted to further develop themselves to get their master's or who were going to stick around, because the money isn't very good. So if we find someone who's going to stick around for 2 or 3 years, so that's one of the reasons why the manager's like, take some executive education courses, do these things.
They know you're lucky.
Because that's what they can offer you. They can offer you a higher salary, but they can offer you more educational development, which, if you use it well, you stay there for 2 or 3 years or 2 or 4 years, and then go on to other jobs.
And I think in this field, it's pretty much expected that you're going to get higher degrees. You know, you might get in with a bachelor's degree, but for career growth and just the level of education that you work among, the expectation is kind of, you know, you're going to continue with it.
And I think that is a common question that I get when people are kind of talking to me about getting into higher ed, is do I need a master's, right? And I think, you know, probably not for your first job, but I think in order to have a career, I think you do. And, you know, I know Pam had mentioned the faculty interaction, and I think that actually there can be some cons to that, especially if you don't have a higher degree, because there is this kind of maybe law school faculty are different than others, but this assumption that they're smarter than you, they're better than you, they know better than you, and that at least if you have that kind of degree on your wall, it's kind of a sick thing. That, I mean, I'm not any smarter than I was before I got my master's degree, honestly, but they take me a little bit more seriously than they used to. And so I think that in order to move into a level of managerial or into a place where you're interacting with PhDs, with, you know, law faculty, with business faculty, they, you do kind of just need that in order to have a level of credibility.
Which is, what do you think areas for advancement are, and what possible career paths can you speak to in your field?
I'll start.
You've advanced a lot.
I would say that higher education is a place where they really do, obviously, recognize learning. And so the more that you can learn about your institution and the different facets of your institution, it really does allow you to move within. So I've moved from fundraising to student affairs to now a research center working with faculty. Very different roles and very different for my part by design. My ultimate goal is to be a university president, so I need to understand how the institution works from all different angles. A note on the money. I will say that probably while I think personally that there's lots of room for advancement, and obviously at a large institution there's many jobs that are open. When we had a little hiring freeze a couple of years ago with the economy, that was not the case. But for the most part, that's rebounded, and there's pages and pages and pages of jobs at Columbia and NYU. So once you have your foot in the door and you're one place, it is easier to move your given priority, things of that nature. I have found, though, that in the past, since 2003, I've been promoted 4 times. And while that's wonderful and it comes with a lot of responsibility and title changes, it doesn't come with the money that it should, considering, you know, somebody else that they would hire externally. So that's something to consider, and I would say, you know, as a woman, maybe I didn't ask for what I really deserved from the first job that I got at the institution, and so that's been a hindrance, something that I've been fighting ever since, but it's a lot harder. And with this last promotion and job, I really had to look at the whole package and say, what am I getting out of this? It's not just about the money. Yeah, I would love to make more money. But my goal is to look at PhD programs after this master's, to become a professor, and so the professor that I'm working with right now is one of our top professors. And what I'm learning from her about being a faculty member, about how the institution works from her perspective, for me, is priceless. So I think when looking at advancement opportunities, you have to look at the whole package and not just the money. And, you know, the benefits are great, but also what are you getting out of that? When I went to student affairs, what I looked at, what I was getting out of there was the ability to think on my feet. I mean, I was always, you know, a pretty flexible person, but with 1,500 students and all these events, you really have to be ready to shift gears at a moment's notice. And so, you know, the other part of this new job is that it's really a solitary job. It's myself and a professor. So I've kind of gone from one extreme to the other. And so I think figuring out the benefits that the positions will bring you, not just when it comes to money, but other things are really important. And yes, I think there's plenty of opportunity for advancement in higher education if you work hard.
Yeah, I think that my story may be slightly unique, but it's still, I think, very possible. I started... because I had talked to another jet, and I had talked to other people, and they said, you have to go get a master's, and I was like, okay, I don't want to pay for a master's degree, so what can I do? And I found this admin assistant job that was like 9 to 5, brainless, whatever, but I got my master's at night, so I said I was going to go work at OISS afterwards, and then, ended up liking what I was doing and also really, you know, getting to know my boss and telling her. And I think that's a big part of being able to advance. I think, like Jillian said, people, they look for people who want to learn. They look to support you, your ability to move if possible. And so then, you know, I happened to, I finished my degree and I was actually interviewing at Columbia and very close to getting an offer, and my boss called me and was like, we really don't want you to leave. And it just so happens that there's a position, you know, for assistant director, and while you wouldn't be qualified if you came from outside because you've been here already, we know you, I'm going to push for you if you want it, you know, and then since then, you know, they do recognize growth. I think that there is the downside to everybody loving their jobs in higher ed, though, is that nobody leaves, ever. And I have a kind of an entry-level position in my office that we joke is a 2-year position because which is horrible for me as a manager because every 2 years I have to fill this position. But there's nowhere, you know, we keep hiring these really bright, intelligent, motivated, driven people who are fantastic, and then they're like, well, there's nowhere for me to go because the director's not quitting, the dean's not quitting. You know, like, nobody's quitting because we all love our jobs. And so you do have to kind of carve out, you know, you have to be on the lookout for your next opportunity. The woman who just left our assistant director role in the law school is now assistant dean for pre-professional advising at the undergrad school at NYU. So, you know, we're a large enough institution that there was an opportunity for her to move up within our institution. But it might not be that easy, and that can be frustrating, especially if you're the kind of person who wants a higher title, a higher salary, not just more responsibility, because I think that people are always happy to give you more responsibility, always. But if you kind of need to be recognized for that, which you should be, you might need to try to, you know, branch out. And that's where networking and knowing people at other schools, and, you know, New York City is fantastic because there are so many schools, and there are organizations like IIE, which, you know, don't exist in a lot of other places. So keeping in touch with people like that, keeping in touch with whatever, if you're in student advising or career services or development with the professional organizations that are nationwide that are in your area, I think are essential because people will recognize. And, you know, one of the reasons that NYU did promote me was because I published at least 2 or 3 times a year articles in our kind of national professional association. And, you know, I mean, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know anything about international law. But people think of me as one of the, you know, experts in the country on getting international law students jobs. And that's mostly just because I took the time to write an article about it, not because I actually know more than anyone else at any other school.
My next question is kind of a difficult one, but where do you see this industry progressing in the next 5 or 10 years? It's kind of a broad question.
At Columbia, though, we just had, it was a bit of a surprise in April. They all of a sudden said there's the task force on benefits changing, and they were taking away the tuition benefit. Mm-hmm. A lot of the staff was kind of up in arms because we find it very hard to hire intelligent mm-hmm. people who are working, looking to tuition.
Kept saying, now they're all coming to NYU.
I was like, NYU does it. So it's something we're still fighting, I think. I'm not sure. But that's something that is difficult with the industry because they're cutting, because people don't want to leave their jobs. Mm-hmm. So we have really qualified people right now, you know. But I think you need to keep these people coming in who have the fresh ideas and such. So that's the difficult thing that Columbia is struggling with, I think, now. But, I mean, overall, our work is wonderful.
Go violence.
Go violence.
I would say that what Pat's referring to is overall fiscal issues at universities. And I think, and I just think that that's something that is a reality for higher education now. The cost of higher education has mm-hmm. just spiraled. It's, you know, outpacing inflation by Lord knows how many percentage points. So I think that's an issue that all universities are facing. And with that, my personal opinion is that the 10-year structure is going to have to be looked at. I think many institutions are bringing contingent faculty, adjunct faculty. Those ranks are really swelling in numbers. And that's because there's something about tenure that's maybe not working. And I, you know, from my education and my courses, I believe in academic freedom, but I also believe that every member of the institution has to produce. And what tenure does is allow older faculty to not really produce as much. And so I think that's an issue that's overall going to be dealt with these fiscal issues.
I think that, maybe Pam and I are drinking John Sexton's Kool-Aid. I don't know if you are, but right? That NYU has this focus on the global network university, right? Where we're now, we have 3 places where you can be an NYU student, not just a study abroad student, not a student who's, spending a semester abroad, but you can be an NYU student in New York, Abu Dhabi, or student in Shanghai. And that's certainly our president's message, as this is where higher ed is going, is because, you know, globalization. And actually, I think this is a place where jets have an advantage because we're part of that global community of people who are moving back and forth and feel comfortable in multiple countries and multiple settings and multiple cultures. And, I think there there are a lot of other schools signing on to it, and it's even, you know, I'm a career counselor in the law school. That shouldn't really be, except for the international students, it shouldn't really be international at all, but we have a program in Singapore, you know, that I'm going to next week to meet with our students, and it does seem to be something that, you know, my boss, when she started 30 years ago, said she never would have fathomed was something that would be required of a career counselor in her office, and now it's not even, like, it wasn't even a question of, like, can you travel to Singapore? It was like, okay, here are your dates, please buy your tickets, and go to Singapore and let us know how that goes. And I think that I do see a lot more of that, and not just because it's sexy and looks good in PR, but because, there, you know, people really do see value to what it brings in.
And I would say also, I mean, aside from having a passion and an interest in the field of education, in general, I think overall, regardless of how economies are doing, education is not going to shrink. You know, it's a field that's going to continue to grow, whether it's more limited in the U.S. comparatively. You know, right now the Middle East is huge in terms of in terms of higher education growth. So many countries already globally have such a low level of involvement in higher education, and you know, one of IIE's purposes is to increase that. You know, how can we increase? We don't do programs in the U.S. You know, we only do programs if they're, you know, supporting students who are outside of the U.S. And yes, sometimes U.S. students, you know, loop into global programs, or the Fulbright portion of the U.S. students that go abroad, yes, they're U.S. students. But, you know, in general, our whole focus is outside of the U.S. And I think, you know, that piece that globally there's still so much available to contribute to that international higher education growth. It's going to happen, but it's going to be in very different structures than is currently happening now, and maybe even different ways than the higher education in the U.S. is set up. But, you know, just as Claire was saying, and IIE is involved in this in a way too. John Sexton is one of the board members for IIE, or the board of trustees, and, you know, we work, IIE works with recruiting students for scholarships through the NYU Abu Dhabi campus. So it's this focus on, you know, how can we look outside of the U.S. and still continue to support these higher education initiatives. And I think that, again, puts a JET in a really great place because, you know, if you're flexible, if you're interested in potentially working outside the U.S. again, there are definitely opportunities there that you can become involved in that will really have the potential to grow. So, and like I said, I think the Middle East is just a huge focus right now. I know it is for IIE. I mean, Africa, yes, but the money is in the Middle East, and I think there's a lot of funding going on there for higher education.
And I think, I mean, China, right?
I was about to say.
China. Right. And there was this huge article in the New York Times really recently about the China conundrum, about all these Chinese students coming to the U.S. I mean, that if you're interested in international ed specifically, I think just the fact that there are, what, 2 billion people in China is, means that you have to pay attention to
and
people
India,
going to
yeah,
China,
yeah.
People coming from China, and India, too.
And,
no question.
Yeah. We get people all the time in my office just wanting to learn from Columbia and how they organize their things. It's just, we take a lot of the courtesy meetings and such, but that's something you can take your experience here, work at a university here 2 or 3 years, and then go over and be like, oh, I got to help you guys there. Yeah.
Okay, those are all really actually... I thought about them, but and I think the last question I have is probably what's on most people's minds. How do you think, you know, they kind of can manage getting into, you know, getting their foot into the door? So what would be your best advice or one piece of advice that you would give?
So one thing that a couple people mentioned is starting out at the admin level. One thing to keep in mind is that even though it looks like a clerical, technical position, you actually do have a lot of responsibility. And so because you have responsibility, you'll be able to put in a resume and kind of use that as tangible skill. So even though I was never an admin, but I know a lot of people who are admins and then moved up.
I would caution not to do it for too long.
Yeah.
Right. And to really, from the very beginning, start making connections with the higher ups in your office. That, like, because then there's this very clear divide, you know, between like this person is just an admin or this person is
you don't want to be a lifer.
Right.
There are lifers at on campuses.
Yeah.
And I think if you show that you're proactive and want to learn, that will help.
And their benefits are even better than ours.
Right.
I mean, your tuition, I mean, your salary is not terrible. The benefits are even better than mine. You get it's 9 to 5 or overtime. But if you do it for more than a year or two, you might get kind of, it might be harder to move yourself out.
I'm sorry, I didn't want to interrupt you, but I wanted to put that
out. You need to get a master's.
Right.
That's the perfect way to be admin until you're done with your master's and then out.
Yeah. Or on to the
position. Or on to the move up.
What about, I mean, I hear at NYU they have, you know, you have to go through HR and that's kind of the hard step to get past. So what are your advice for people, you know, who don't really have their foot in the door, don't know anyone in HR, but want to get in the field?
I'll say this much for jobs, and I took this route when I started, when I tried to get a job at Columbia not knowing anybody. Every posting, at least on the Columbia website, tells you the school, the division, the department, and who you're reporting to in terms of title. It may not tell you the person's name. And I find that as a hiring manager, when I would get, you know, resumes, I was getting hundreds of resumes. So it really is helpful to find the name of the person that you're actually going to have to interview with and email them your resume. And, you know, I'm dating myself a little, but like back, you know, when you still faxed in resumes, I would go on a directory, and if I couldn't figure out from the directory who that person was, I would call like the admin assistant. And if you're super friendly and just, you know, let them know why you're calling, like, so many people were so helpful to me and just said, oh, it's this person's a name, and fax it to me right now, and I'll make sure it gets on their desk. And I have to say, sending it into, you know, that HR, you know, website, even is just, you don't know where it went, you don't know the status of it. And some people may think that's a little too pushy. I personally think that it's really important to make sure that you are getting your resume seen by the right people. HR's job is to weed you out. Mm-hmm. Their job is to see that you, you know, made a mistake in your cover letter, you're done. As a hiring manager, I was a little bit more forgiving, not very forgiving. But I also took the time, one person had a great resume and didn't submit a cover letter. I actually called her and said, I would love to interview you, but I don't, unless you write me a cover letter. So for the next job that you apply for, you need to write a cover letter. And so that was my style, you know, how I approached hiring. But I definitely think making sure, and then networking, we've all said it in one way, shape, or form. Being able to get out there and make sure that people in your life know what you're looking for, to be open and maybe broaden. Somebody said also they broaden their search. You can be really specific in what you want, but recognize that there are stepping stones, and you may not come into an institution at the level or the position or even the office that you want to be in, but if it's something that is interesting to you, it's something that will help you get closer to that ultimate goal.
And also look at some of the professional schools. We value people who have business experience. So if you are someone who's coming in and you're not at an entry level, you know, look at some like alumni relations or development offices that are more outside facing, and that will be your step into higher ed, and then you might be a step in. Because my experience also was I started out as like a program officer position, and I moved my way up. And when we hire people, we look at people who have some higher ed experience, but just a little bit, and are going to stick around for a while, and to move them up within our organization. So, and it really helps if you've worked in another university. But, okay, you know what you're dealing with. You know what the paycheck is. Okay, good.
Yeah, and I would echo that, too. I mean, I think a lot of the group, and at least some that I've talked to, in my own opinion, and even as we talked up here, your goal is, you know, international student office or study abroad. And those are tough offices to get into. And I think you can still have an experience once you get into the university, and you can still have experiences with international students that aren't as focused. And I think one of the places, or a couple of the places that you could, offices that you could look into are admissions. I mean, that's an externally facing office in terms of recruitment. You know, if you can get into a position like that where you're helping to identify or create interest within students who might come to that university, oftentimes there will be at least a component of that office that works with outreach to international students, because they all want some, to say they have some international students there. And I think student affairs and student activities, I mean, you're not only working with international students, but certainly if there's international students at the university, then part of that comes through. And student advising, I mean, alumni also is another one where...
And that's growing, alumni.
Alumni is huge and growing. And it's
okay, for international.
International in particular, but I think just in general, just the idea of trying to bring money into the institution and alumni is a great way, you know, I mean, that's one of the ways to stay focused. And so then if you have students who have gone through who are international students, now you're working at kind of maintaining that relationship with them. So I would say, you know, looking at those types of offices as well that then may get you more focus into the experience for the study abroad or the international student.
And big universities also have, like where Jillian is now, research institutes that may not be student-facing at all in some cases, but some of them are focused on certain international areas, geographic areas, certain issues, certain, you know, and you may find that your background, you know, you were in an activity, you know, in undergrad or you lived in Japan and this is an East Asian institute or something like that, makes you qualified to work there, and that can also be your foot in the door. And there are always students, you know, working with these professors or kind of, you know, interfacing with these research centers and research institutes, even if you, you know, don't if you don't have an office where you're counseling them one-on-one, and that can also be, I think a lot of people overlook that, and can be a really good way to try to get in to universities. And I think, I mean, networking. Let everyone you know ask them, like, do you know anyone who works at Columbia? Do you know anyone who works at Hofstra? Do you know anyone? And don't, like, NYU and Columbia are not the only two schools in New York City. We may be the only two schools up here, but there are so many schools in New York, and they're, just because they're not NYU and Columbia, I mean, there's so much fantastic work at all of these schools, and they need people at all of these schools that you should definitely be looking beyond. And if you're geographically flexible, that gives you even more.
Right. I mean, there's higher ed institutions everywhere.
And every,
so,
you know, if you're women, it goes from all.
It's very transferable, you know?
Right. There's a lot of options.
It's one thing to know. Yeah.
I've
interviewed some people,
oh, yeah,
and they haven't sent baby notes, and I think that's really rude.
And two, proofread. I mean, maybe Jillian's forgiving, but I am not. I mean, I'm a career counselor, right? So if you can't get your own resume right, you're definitely not working for me. But I mean, that's such a huge thing. Like, please proofread it, you know. And if your thank you note is written, like, if I get a thank you note that says, "Dear Shannon, thank you so much for meeting with me today," like, okay, I don't care how great you were, I'm not going to hire you because my name's not Shannon.
But it was in the wrong school is also.
Oh, good.
It's so obvious, and it's like a more job letter. You want to make sure that you're tailoring your information to the right job. I would say also that the higher education, the hiring process within higher education is a little bit slower than maybe people are used to.
Oh, yeah.
So think about the cycle of the school, of the position that you're applying for. For instance, when they were filling my role, it was posted a month before orientation began. My former boss, she knew she was not going to really be able to start looking at candidates seriously until orientation was done.
Mm-hmm.
So keeping that in mind is really important, and then also just remembering that we share resumes internally. I can't tell you how many times Katrina's boss would send us a resume, we would do the same. So making sure that when you're going in for interviews, whenever you're communicating, that you really are putting yourself, you know, your best foot forward, because if you impress one person, it may not be the right fit for that role for whatever reason, but they'll remember you, and they'll pass along your resume, and even asking, are there other opportunities? I can't tell you how many people came into our school, interviewed for something, and actually ended up somewhere else. And that's because they made an impression, and people felt like, you know what, this is a good person for our institution. It's not right for this role, but something else might be right. So that's really
and if you get as far as getting called in for an interview and you feel like it was a good experience, even if you get rejected, I mean, you've already been rejected once, so the worst that can happen is they reject you again, but don't be afraid to contact the person you interviewed with and say, "That's really great. I'm, you know, I'm sorry it didn't work out for this, but I'm really, really interested, and even could I come in and talk to you a little bit more about, you know, because, you know, your organization in general, your office in general, your school in general, whatever." And you know, people have done that for me, and that kind of solidified, like, oh, wow, this person is serious, you know, and maybe I would pass that risk down.
And asking for feedback, I think it's really, it's hurtful when you don't get a job, but I can't tell you how many times I was able to provide, you know, some candidates that I rejected with some feedback that if they didn't go into their next interview and do the same thing they did with me, that's a good thing. So, you know, some people won't take the time, you know, to do that, but a lot of people will, and again, because we're talking higher education as the lifelong learner,
right,
people really respond to others who want to better themselves and want to learn about how they can be a better professional. So I look upon that favorably when somebody asks me for feedback, and I truly try to give them real feedback that was actionable.
I think you have to be a little careful, though, because a lot of places won't do. I mean, IIE is very strongly against following up afterwards, so it really just depends
on. I mean, so they reject you again, right? I mean, so then they say no, and fine,
be careful about expecting that to happen.
Right. Oh, yeah. Right. But if they do it, then it helps.
Especially in the middle of orientation, if they do
that. Yeah, right. 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 Right.
Okay, so I try to see things. So informational interviews are really good because then all of a sudden you know more people. Actually, I did interviews with
you. It was me, personally.
Also, your undergraduate institution. So talk to administrators, undergraduate, or look at your alumni network. Mm-hmm. So use those two resources. And also, when you apply for jobs at your undergrad, they're more likely to be favorably. So another Jet alum, Chow, who's not here today, she's out of Philly, but she went to Penn for undergrad, and she focused her search a lot in Philly at Penn. And she was really successful because they're looking, they know that she has a background at Penn. And so that's one thing to think about, is also looking at your undergrad.
And yes, I gave Chow an offer the same day that Penn did.
Oh, really?
Oh, that's so funny.
Penn won. But, you know, use that.
So many people get jobs through
each other.
But also don't go into that expectation, I guess.
No, right.
Because a lot of my friends, especially from grad school, they'll email me and they'll be like, can you give me a job at NYU? And they won't tell me like what they want a job in or like anything about them. But I'm just like, you know, I don't know what's open.
You have to go into some kind of approach. And I think usually if I get contacted in that manner, I'll say, please look at our website, and if you see a job posting that you like, let me know. Because if you just come to me and say, like, help me get a job, it's like, well, give me a little more than that to work with, because I need to know, you know, what you're kind of interested in and where your focus is, and if there's something specific, even if it's at other universities, and sometimes I'll ask that too, you know, what other jobs have you applied to? Like, show me the kind of work that you think you want to be doing. So,
for example, my friend applied for a job at Duke, and I knew somebody at the office because I used to work with them at NYU, and it's like, you know, she knew that because she mentioned it to me, and so just kind of putting in things like that, and also for the what Jillian said about solo taking a long time. I applied for a job in August. I didn't hear back for like 5 weeks, so I figured they were just gone to the world. And I asked my old boss to contact somebody at Wagner to see what the status was, and they said nothing to her. So I was like, oh great, I'm definitely not going to get this job. But 4 months later, I was working there. So it does take a while. So, yeah.
All right, well, I just want to thank all of our wonderful panelists for sharing their experiences and advice. I think it was really helpful to me, too, so thank you very much. And